Well, we're talking about a disease that not a lot of people know about, but you will by the time this program is over. Our special guest tonight, Tom Grier, as we talk about Lyme disease on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Tom, we were talking about some kind of criteria here, and I'd like you to explain what that is.
Well, diagnosis of Lyme disease has been controversial for almost since the beginning. But when Yale really promoted this idea of what's called two-tiered testing, I think it created really the belief that testing is acceptable for making the diagnosis of Lyme disease. And the trouble with this is the tests are so poor, and they're actually designed that way. Now, if the first test is 50% inaccurate, and then the second test, after they changed the reporting criteria, is about only 50% accurate, well, what are the chances of you getting a positive Lyme test? Well, if you multiply 50% times 50%, it's about a 25% chance. That's statistics. But the another problem with these tests is they're antibody-based tests. Not every Lyme patient makes adequate antibodies, and you have to give the test at the right time. If you're bitten by a tick today, mm-hmm. your Lyme test probably won't be positive for 30 days.
Jeez.
So are you going to wait 30 days before you seek treatment, even if you have symptoms? And that's one of the problems. From the time this bacteria enters your body, it's penetrating blood vessels, and it's circulating. Now, I would tell your readers, if you want to actually see this in a video, just go to Google and look at spirochetes unwound. And a Canadian researcher, and this is in real time, and this is what's amazing, he took living mice, and he dyed their blood vessels red in their ear. Then he took immune fluorescent antibody and dyed the bacteria bright green so you can see it. And then he injected the mice. The bacteria attaches to a blood vessel, creates a hole, and penetrates into the tissue in 1.5 minutes, 90 seconds. That's all it takes.
That's fast.
Well, but now imagine that you're going to wait 30 days before you get the results of your test back, before you get treated or even diagnosed. And
well, this infection then could run rampant through your body.
Yeah, it can get everywhere. And once it gets into places like what we call sequestered sites, into the joints, the connective tissue, the heart, the brain, especially the brain, it is almost impossible to detect with serology tests. And that's why we're asking for better pathology studies. We've been advocating for this for over 10 years, and we just can't get them to budge on this. We want a multi-center study looking at brain autopsies in dementia patients, Alzheimer's patients, MS patients, and people with a history of chronic Lyme. And I think once we look at those results, we can draw some accurate conclusions. But right now, we're just operating on hypotheses and theories that are saying Lyme disease is a self-limiting disease.
Is there a seasonality to Lyme disease, Tom?
Well, certainly. We see that in the spring when the nymphs are first hatching. If you're bit in April or May, you're most likely to develop symptoms in July. So now that bacteria has been circulating in your body since May and you're getting diagnosed in July, that's a long time to go. So a lot of these patients, when they are treated with 2 weeks of antibiotics, we see that a month or so later, they relapse. And this creates another problem because the Infectious Disease Society of America, which really tells physicians how to diagnose and treat this illness, has pretty much put absolute terms out there saying that you have to treat with doxycycline and you have to treat for 2 weeks, and after that, you'd have no need to treat any longer. Now, insurance companies love that but it's not really good science, and it's certainly not good medicine, and it's not good for any Lyme patient with late-stage Lyme disease.
All right, let's go to some of the calls we've got here. Alex in Hollywood, California. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing great, thanks.
I have Lyme disease, and I can't, I'm sure you've heard my story a million times, and I can't get anyone to treat me or test me for it. So I've been treating it naturally, and I just, I don't know, I really kind of want to, I would love for you to check out my blog, but I would like to know, how do I go about getting tested to see what's going on? Because I also, when I was 18, I had syphilis, so it's interesting. They gave me like 3 shots in the bum with penicillin, and I'm, after fighting this Lyme disease, I have Morgellons as well. After fighting this the last 16, 17 months, I'm thinking the penicillin wasn't enough.
All right.
You know,
what do you recommend here, Tom?
Well, there's some thought that bactericidal antibiotics like penicillin and the cephalosporins, that they actually kill the bacteria when they divide, but they don't get inside cells very well, and we think some of this bacteria goes intracellular in human cells, and it also pushes the bacteria into an alternative form called the cyst form. And the cyst form is especially prevalent in the brain, and it's very hard to detect and to test for. But regular antibiotics like penicillin and amoxicillin and so on don't really affect the cyst form. And there's been 2 or 3 very good papers just recently that have outlined this, one by Dr. Ava Sappi from New Haven, Connecticut. And she has tested some of the natural things that might not only attack the cyst form, but also what we call biofilms. Now, the antibiotics doxycycline and the macrolides, they don't promote the cyst form, but also they don't seem to kill the cyst form. So what we're thinking is, now that you've already had antibiotic therapy with intramuscular penicillin, that it might be time to look at something like metronidazole, which is known to kill the cyst form. Maybe adding what they do in Europe, grapefruit seed extract, which also helps promote this breakdown of this form. But you have to discuss this with a doctor and have a doctor who's willing to try these things. Now, one thing that you can do on your own, and I have a really great story about penicillin and syphilis in 1945 during the war.
All right.
But here's the thing. Heat is an enemy of this bacteria.
Heat?
Yes, heat. Hyperthermia treatments. And you have to be careful. I mean, I'm not advocating that you know, cook yourself alive here.
Yeah, don't microwave yourself.
But I really think a big key to my success in treatment was I combined it with hot tubbing and I kept the water at 108 degrees, and this is above the normal temperature that we would consider tolerable.
Which is as hot as you want to get it.
Yeah, 105 is what most people can tolerate, but this bacteria really doesn't start to die until you get it to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, and even then we can't get the core temperature up to that. We can only get the skin temperature up. But it turns out the skin is a place where a lot of the bacteria goes dormant and can survive. We have instances where people have had a Lyme rash, and 10 years later we've been able to culture the bacteria out of that rash. So we know it can hide and survive in the skin. So getting the skin temperature up in temperature can possibly be effective in part of this treatment.
Of course, you'll probably look like a prune, Tom, when you get out of the hot tub, right?
Very, very true. I've heard some big stories, and all of this comes from the experience with treating syphilis. Prior to World War II, the availability of penicillin was very low, and so the primary treatment for syphilis was hyperthermia or hot tubbing and steam cabinets.
Interesting. I'm not a fan of vaccines, but is there one for Lyme disease?
Well, our nonprofit organization was very much opposed to the vaccine that did come out. 2 years before it came out, we had written articles saying that it was a poorly designed vaccine and could potentially cause problems.
Oh,
and we were not the only ones. There were many others that put their hat in the ring for not developing this vaccine. And the reason is they chose a protein to make the vaccine out of that was a protein on the bacteria called outer surface protein A. And it turns out if you have had a history of Lyme disease, that protein may have embedded itself in your joints. So now if you're going to make antibodies with the vaccine against that protein, you're actually attacking your own joints. And this was the fear. The company, SmithKline-Beecham, took the vaccine off the market voluntarily, but there's still pending lawsuits because of arthritis that happened. And it was also known that patients with a tissue type called HLA-DR4 were especially prone to this type of arthritis that the vaccine could initiate. And so even though it was voluntarily withdrawn, I think it was really a poor decision to go ahead with it. And we have people in our support group that are absolutely devastated from the vaccine. So I've
Good stand that, Lisa. Yeah. I'm glad you took that position. Let's go to Chicago, Illinois. Arlene's with us east of the Rockies. Good morning, Arlene.
Hi, good morning. I just want to make sure I have the names correct and any information because my husband was diagnosed. They found the Lyme's in his blood. Fortunately, our cardiologist internist did a test after we visited my brother in Missouri and found the Lyme's. He does have dementia. He does have a heart problem. He has a problem in the joints. In fact, his joint is so bad that the surgeons don't want to operate, because of the heart condition. They said leave him alone because he doesn't feel any pain. This man walks. It's very difficult. He doesn't feel the pain. There are incidents where he was seeing people. I mean, everything he's talking about. I'm going to call my cardiologist, and I want to have it really straight that I can have him do the research because he gets an IV every 2 weeks. The doctor gives him an IV. He's also on what they call ECP, external pulsation, compression pulsation, ECP. And that I drive this guy Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to my doctor's where he has these beds to help his heart, which his heart is slowly getting better. However, the blood, the doctor said, is still not getting to the brain. He's not getting that extra oxygen that he should have. And when he's getting these ECP treatments, he does get oxygen Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I take him there. He gets an hour treatment on the bed, half hour relaxation, and then another hour. And it's helping the heart, but as far he can no longer drive. And sometimes he didn't know me, and then he does know me. Everything that you say, but I want to make sure. I hope Coast to Coast is going to have a link up. And I think at first I thought you were Dr. Andrew Peckner.
This is Tom the victim who decided
Tom
to do
victim.
This full time.
That's why I want to make sure in how you spell your last name, Tom, because I want to make sure I give all this information to my cardiologist. And we should probably be seeing a neurologist.
Would you like me to give some contact information here?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. And also, I just want everyone to know that your websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com.
Good. Excellent.
Everybody has it. Go ahead.
Two ways to get a hold of our organization is, one is email is, it's just donatebrain@gmail.com, all lowercase.
Okay.
And our mailing address is MIBDEC, MIBDEC, Box 323, Box 323. The address is 1346 West Arrowhead Road, and that is Duluth, Minnesota, 55811.
You know, I worked for a year, Tom, in Minneapolis back in 1978 to 79 at KSTP Television down there.
Oh.
Had a great time. Boy, was it cold in those days. Is it still cold in Minnesota?
Well, it is where I live. Yes, sir. It's actually pretty cold right now.
Do other countries get Lyme disease?
Oh, this is a worldwide phenomenon. Like I said, when I published my book in 1995, it was, I've been to international Lyme conferences. I've been to about 20 of them, and I have actually seen stacks of my book Xeroxed and on tables where they are giving them away or selling them and such. So because I stopped printing it, and people just kept reprinting it because there was no information out there that was meant for the patient.
It's almost like Morgellons disease, where nobody knows what these things are. Well, at least Lyme disease is, at least some people are starting to study it. I wish more people would study Morgellons disease, Tom.
Oh, absolutely. We need to get to the bottom of it. When Morgellons first started out, their website was very elusive, and it wasn't very science-oriented, and now I'm glad to see that they're really trying to go after the science of this. And for those that don't know, I mean, it can cause terrible itching and secretions in the skin, and we just don't know what it is. Yeah.
Let's go to Seminole, Oklahoma, and get you in, Kathy, before the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. While I was on hold, I thought of another point I wanted to bring up, too. That quite a few fibromyalgia patients may in fact be Lyme patients that have been misdiagnosed. But
yeah.
What I primarily called about was whether he had looked into any of the successes so far that patients are experiencing with either Rife therapy or something called MMS. Which is basically sodium chloride mixed with,
All right, and of course, Royal Rife had a machine that some people are still using. Do you recommend anything done naturally, Tom?
Well, there are some things that seem to work. Let's see if I have... what I would recommend is looking up Dr. Ava Sappi's latest paper, where she actually puts to test some things like cemento, and she had some other recommendations. Grapefruit seed extract seems to help some patients. But overall, I have to say that in support group over 20 years, the natural things have not panned out as well as antibiotics.
Interesting.
But it goes both ways. I mean, antibiotics clearly is not the answer in every patient. We have a very difficult time in curing patients. I did want to go back to one thing that the previous caller had said about heart failure and heart problems.
All right, hold on to that. We'll talk right about that, Tom, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour we'll continue to take your phone calls as well, the special 2 hours of phone calls as we talk about Lyme disease. And by the looks of things, lots of people have this concern all around North America, all over the place. Hey, for 25 cents, less than that, a day, you can become a Coast Insider and join the club and take advantage if you're into the podcasting world and you like your iPhones and Androids and downloading and just to have some fun. Just sign up for Coast to Coast's Coast Insider by going to coasttocoastam.com. And we'll be back in a moment more with Tom Grier and Lyme disease on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Tom, what did you want to say about heart failure and heart problems?
Oh, okay. This is one of those studies that you would never see because it was never published, but it was presented at an international Lyme symposia. And it was from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Jesse Goodman and Dr. Russell Johnson. And what they looked at was they had 91 patients that were awaiting cardiac heart transplant. Mostly because of an enlarged heart, myocarditis and myocardiopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they just, for whatever reason, decided that they would randomly test all of these people for Lyme disease. And out of the 91 patients waiting for heart transplant, 8% were highly positive for Lyme disease, and another 13% were positive. So we had 21% of the patients awaiting heart transplant in 1990 testing very positive for Lyme disease. Now, we don't hear about that anymore because now heart transplant patients are routinely tested. And we had people here in Duluth that were actually on the cardiac transplant list, and after 6 months of antibiotics, their myocardiopathy improved to the point where they're no longer on that list. Some of these people are in our documentary that we're currently filming. We've been filming a Lyme disease documentary in Twigg, Minnesota for a year and a half. And what we have come across is just amazing. It would just astound you. So, when we talk about cardiac complications, we're talking about right up to the point of having to have a heart transplant.
That's amazing. All right, let's go to some of the calls. Patrick in Warren, Michigan. First-time caller. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Hello, Mr. Greer, Mr. Norrie.
Hi.
Nice to speak with you.
Good day.
I became ill in September of 96. It, something hit me really, really instantly, an unknown illness, and I've been downhill ever since.
Do you think you might have this, Lyme disease?
Well, the initial diagnosis was the Epstein-Barr virus, the chronic fatigue syndrome, and the fibromyalgia. And then I had two chief infectious disease doctors diagnose me with Lyme B. burgdorferi. And I was treated with the PIC line with doxycycline and rocephin. And, that PIC line got plugged up and it had to be removed. I had no choice but to quit my job. It was September. I was sunbathing, and I happened to reach out and catch one of those big black flying ants, and it bit me in my hand. So that could be a coincidence. And a few days later, I decided to place a personals ad, and I got in contact with the woman, and I had a one-nighter with the woman. Now, 4 days later, this illness hit me. And besides the fact that the infectious disease doctor said that would be too soon for for any type of disease to generate, you know, it would have to be over at least 12 days or 2 weeks.
Well, it's hard to comment on this. One thing, are you located in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, or?
No, Warren, Michigan's near Detroit.
Yeah, all right. Because I got to tell you, for a long time, it was very difficult with the health department in Michigan to get them to admit that they had Lyme disease.
I'm disgusted with the false negatives and the false positive test results.
Right. But their way of excluding Lyme disease was simply that we tested the ticks. We don't have infected ticks, so you can't get Lyme disease. My gosh, I guess people don't travel, you know.
Well, I'm not a hunter. You know, at first I thought I had AIDS. I've never had a positive STD result.
Yeah.
Now, there was one positive syphilis, but all the other ones were negative. But then it came out to be a false positive after they did the RPR test.
Yeah.
And after hundreds of emergency room visits and doctors, I've sought medical help out of state 5 times. I go to neurosurgery sometimes, and they tell me to go to ear, nose, and throat, and vice versa. They tell me to go back to neurosurgery.
Yeah.
I do have a cyst in the pineal region with calcium deposits around it and possibly fluoride. And it's over a centimeter, and I was probably born with it, but I think it gets affected by whatever I'm going with. And it's hard not having a proper diagnosis because you have no idea where to go with this.
Right, and you may be dealing with many medical problems. Just because you might have a tick-borne illness doesn't exclude you from having other disorders. And I think at this point you're going to have to seek out to rule out Lyme disease, see a practitioner who specializes in Lyme.
Mr. Greer, really, I've seen dozens, and I really don't think it's any help to seek medical help. I think you need to be your own doctor, and you need to do healthy practice. And I am taking penicillin, but you really need a lot of emotional support.
Yeah.
I do get the neck clicks, and I'm slightly overweight, and I thought maybe I have a heavy brain or something, you know.
Well, it is important to have a good support system, the people around you and
yeah.
your doing.
Critical.
But the other thing that's important for you to do is to be objective. You should start a medical journal and really look at what your symptoms are and if they improve while you're on penicillin. Now, penicillin is in that class where we think it can't do the whole job. A lot of people have gone through this. We just don't think one antibiotic may be able to do the whole job because this bacteria can change. And so you might have to seek out a practitioner that's willing to treat the other form of this bacteria. And I'm not a doctor, so I can't give you specific medical advice or diagnose you on the phone. But I think that to be objective, you want to list your symptoms and really look at response to therapy. And if you're not improving on therapy, then it might not be Lyme disease that we're looking at. It might be something else. And whatever that is, I can't do it over the phone. I don't know what it is.
Tom, why do they call it Lyme disease? L-Y-M-E.
Right. Well, in 1973, two housewives in Old Lyme, Connecticut, started recognizing that there was an unusual number of juvenile rheumatoid arthritis cases in their neighborhood. Now, when I say housewives, they were very sharp ladies. One was also a public health nurse, Polly Murray. And so Polly Murray and Judy Dench, Judy Mensch, did the groundwork. And they collected 280 case histories and presented it to the health department. And then in 1975, I guess it took 2 years for them to be interested, they sent out a rheumatologist named Dr. Alan Steer. And he first described it as Lyme arthritis. And from that point on, for the next 10 years, Lyme disease was pretty much thought as an arthritic disease, and they didn't really see the neurological component yet. And I have always wondered if Polly had collected 280 cases of MS and they treated them, I wonder if we would be looking at this disease completely differently.
Well, that's a good point. Syracuse, New York. Let's go to Charlie. Charlie, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I just wanted to say it's an absolute pleasure to be on the show. You've been
Charlie.
Inspiration of mine. And greetings to Tom, who's a guest on the show tonight. And I just have a couple questions about my recent diagnosis with Lyme disease.
Try to help you.
Here it goes. I was diagnosed with Lyme disease back in July. Came back from the creek near my house, and I had a large ring rash around my back. So I went to the emergency room, and I was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And basically, I had a couple neurological symptoms before I went in there that were kind of disconcerting. Basically, just very difficult to concentrate and some problems concentrating. My girlfriend noticed it originally. So basically, I just wanted to talk about that. And as well, my diagnosis turned into a blood test. And the blood test came back as unequivocal. And I'm not sure exactly what that means. And I'm also wondering, I stopped taking my antibiotics around the time that I had started the treatment for the illness. And I went back into my doctor's, and he actually told me to start taking them again and whatnot. I had some adverse reactions to the medication, so that was kind of an issue. So I was just wondering if you could speak on that a little bit. And, I guess that's about it.
All right.
The other thing is cognitively, what kind of effects could this have?
I didn't catch that last part.
He was breaking up, Tom.
Okay. Let's address his very first question. Is he's having neurological cognitive difficulties. In other words, he's got short-term memory problems, fuzzy thinking, fogginess. I cannot tell you how common this is. Even in early Lyme disease, 90% of Lyme patients report short-term memory loss and fuzzy thinking. It's almost like a fog is in your brain. The only way I can describe it is you wake up one day and you've got the flu. Yeah, you're still alive, but you know something's wrong. You're just not altogether there, and that's what it's like. Now, we think that part of that problem, maybe the infection is in the brain, but we also know that it can activate the release of a substance called quinolinic acid in the brain.
Okay.
And this neurotoxin binds to your brain cells, and it keeps them busy. It keeps them depolarizing. And if you think of all your brain cells as like telephone wires, and all the telephone wires going in and out are constantly busy, it's hard to retrieve information and store information. So it's difficult to learn, and it's difficult to retrieve the information in your own head. Well, quinolinic acid binds to the neuron on a receptor we call the N-methyl D-aspartate receptor, the NMDA receptor. And we can temporarily block this receptor with magnesium, an over-the-counter supplement. And many, many Lyme patients will report an improvement of their cognitive symptoms if they take over-the-counter magnesium supplements, usually twice a day.
Tom, you know, as you look at all this, what else are you doing to try to get the word out about this?
Oh, well, I've got two lectures scheduled this week, and then I'll also be doing a big lecture in Madison, Wisconsin coming up. And we're doing the film documentary. But also, I have available a DVD of lecture material, so we want to get that out. We're trying to register patients for brain autopsies, but we're also trying to get the awareness out so that we can get to better pathology studies. And one thing we did here in Minnesota was we did a multiple sclerosis antibiotic treatment study. And when we were done, we tried to present that information to the Minnesota Health Department. They really didn't seem interested, and they basically just said, MS is not an infectious disease, so why should we report cases of MS, and why should we do a further study? And so it was very, very frustrating. But these are the kinds of things that we continue to keep trying to do.
All right, Michael in Boise, Idaho, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing tonight, George?
Good, Michael.
Good. Hey, I have never called before, and I have always wanted to call on a variety of subjects, but this one caught my attention. I happen to know of some natural remedies that I've been researching as I collect seeds for what I feel is going to happen here in a few years. But I came across a plant called, excuse me for a second, Phytolacca americana root, and it's also called poke. And the gentleman that has been using this, J.L. Hudson Seeds, has said that he has had success in treating Lyme's disease. I also read an article about Manuka honey, which has natural antibiotic capabilities that has also shown to cure Lyme disease. So I didn't know if you were interested or knew anything about that, but I thought I would throw that your way because, you know, I don't want to see anybody die.
I have not heard of these treatments, and I've heard and seen a lot of things come and go over the years. But if you want to send that to our email, you know, I'll certainly take a look at any information we have. I am, more science-oriented and such, and so I haven't really delved in deeply into the natural health side of things. But I look at the microbiology of this bacteria and try to determine, you know, the best things that we can do to get it under control. And right now, it seems like our three best weapons are antibiotics, heat, and oxygen therapy. And unfortunately, oxygen won't do the whole job, but patients certainly feel better if they've had hyperbaric oxygen treatments. But any physician that recommends these comes under the scrutiny of being a quack, and it's really unfortunate because it's an adjunct therapy that it's not going to cure Lyme patients, but it certainly makes a lot of them feel better.
I have a friend of mine who runs some of those chambers, and he said someone was admitted into one of those chambers having severe eye problems, almost going blind, and they were able to save his eyes, and he's able to see now because they just literally pelted his body with oxygen.
Oh, yes. I think there's many treatments like that that we should have a little bit more leeway. You know, they call it the practice of medicine, but I'm telling you, medicine these days has become almost a fascist state. If you're a physician and you're treating Lyme disease aggressively and you're using any alternative methods, you come under scrutiny right away.
Well, that, there's no question about it. You could even lose your license.
Oh, yes. Many, many physicians that treat Lyme disease have lost their license, and there's ongoing battles as we speak in the court. And it's just so unnerving to watch these really decent human beings being persecuted, and then you look at the people that are doing the persecution, and you can just tell who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. In the case I'm really talking about is Dr. Charles Ray Jones, who is really the only nationally recognized authority on treating pediatric Lyme disease. And most doctors really don't want to treat Lyme in kids at all. Because
why?
Well, it's a delicate situation. I mean, kids are like pets. They can't really tell you what's wrong with them. You have to be a good clinician to figure this out. And Lyme disease is a complicated disease, and not everyone responds well to treatment. And so you've got, there's something called, I don't think we talked about the Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction, but they noticed in treating other spirochetal diseases like syphilis and relapsing fever that when you treated these patients, they got worse before they got better. They got fevers and sweats and muscle twitches and extreme pain and muscle problems. And this is because you start killing the bacteria and your immune system kicks into overdrive and pumps out these cytokines and lymphokines that become sort of toxic. And this Herxheimer reaction can be quite severe. In fact, one relapsing fever patient that was misdiagnosed with pneumonia died from his Herxheimer reaction.
When we come back, Tom, I want you to tell us what people can do about this if they have Lyme disease. And also, we'll take an hour of final phone calls. So those of you on hold who've been waiting for some time, just stay there. I'll get to you as soon as we come back, plus some of the new calls on Coast to Coast AM.